Welcome to the CenturyLink Labs podcast with your host, Lucas Carlson. From Docker and Linux containers to programming languages and web frameworks, we interview technology and thought leaders around the world every week. This week's interview is brought to you by CenturyLink Cloud, the world's fastest self-service enterprise-grade cloud.
Hello, this is Lucas Carlson with the CenturyLink Labs podcast. This week, we're talking to James Water, the head of Cloud Foundry, the leader of Cloud Foundry Project, one of the leaders of Pivotal, which is a really cool company that was spun out of VMware, and actually a personal good friend of mine. I really developed a great friendship with this man. Really happy to have him on the podcast because he's a great thinker. He really sees technology trends. He can see the industry. He can see how to apply technology to big problems like large enterprises, which is a really strong talent. That's something that is very, very unique for a technical guy who really gets down into the dirt of the weeds of technical stuff, but also deeply understands the needs of enterprise technology leaders. So, James Waters, thanks for joining us. Can you tell our audience about your background?
Yeah, it was awesome, Lucas. I'm blushing over here, man. It's been great being your friend and being on this adventure with you for the last couple of years. Can't say enough about what you've done, growing the community around Outfog and now growing the community around Docker education and CenturyLink Labs and all the cool stuff you've done with Panamax. So we're really I'm really excited to be on here and talk with you.
Thank you.
My background, I started my career in 1999 working as a engineer on Unix systems and MPLS for a company called Level 3 Communications. And I spent 2 years there developing a voice over IP network and provisioning of MPLS circuits. It's that kind of thing. And I always had my eye on this company over the hill in Colorado called Sun Microsystems. It was where... I remember the day I got my Sun Microsystems offer, I said, Mom, I'm going to work for a real computer company. They make the operating system. They make everything. Like, this is a real deal computer company. I'm so excited. So anyway, I spent 8 years working at Sun on projects like Solaris, and then at the end, some of their hyperscale computing stuff that Andy Bechtolsheim developed for x86. And I came to the conclusion that all the value was migrating from the hardware and the OS up. And I gave myself a little pep talk and said, okay, you're getting your butt kicked on margins here and the hardware. You need to go get a career that's about the software layer that creates value from distributed infrastructure. And so one thing led to another, and I ended up at VMware working on their Cloud Foundry project for the last 4 years. And that's been a real pleasure with some amazingly talented engineers along the way.
Well, since I have you on the show, can you tell us from somebody who's been there since the earliest days, how has Cloud Foundry changed over the years?
Yeah, I think originally, when I tell the story of Cloud Foundry, I talk about how Paul Moritz came from Microsoft, where Microsoft has an incredible server-side technology and Microsoft server. But Paul and Microsoft also built the whole .NET suite out, right, so that you had a development environment for your server technology. And I think when he came to VMware, he felt that he was a little exposed because he had a great infrastructure layer, but he had never connected the developer experience to it. And since the beginning, Cloud Foundry was always VMware's ability to connect cloud applications to the infrastructure in a developer-friendly way. And it started off with a thesis that really the framework was the new thing that people programmed against as opposed to the infrastructure. And I think if you look at that to this day, you still see a lot of development that's driven through frameworks. Even the work that Netflix has done around microservices and Spring Framework, like they discussed last week at Spring One, you still see a lot of programming to that layer even in the cloud. So I think we've been coming to maturity over the last couple years, and the way developers think about infrastructure has changed. The frameworks that people change and the languages they use have changed. So Go language probably is the biggest event that came along in the history of Cloud Foundry to give us a really great infrastructure language with great concurrency. But that's really where it started, is to connect developers to scale an infrastructure for Paul, and it's been a very well-funded, ambitious project ever since.
And what's different about Cloud Foundry now than 4 years ago? I think A lot of people in the audience might have tried Cloud Foundry in the earliest days of V1. What's changed? How is it different?
Yeah, so there's really two big changes that came along in history of it, and it's been 4 years, so pardon me if I don't give every detail along the
way. Yes, the biggest ones, yeah.
I think when we went to build packs and that extensible model where we said, give us arbitrary code or you can give us your own build pack and we'll create the container for you, that was a big step. Before, that was a little bit more locked off. There's a very deterministic pipeline, staging pipeline around how your app got started. And BuildPack was the first signal of true extensibility that we wanted to get into. And I think you were excited about that at the time.
Yes.
And let us plug into a pretty broad ecosystem. And developers didn't know it at the time, but what they were doing was there was a container being created for them. So you gave the system your app, and it created a container and ran it in there with all the runtime context that it needed. So that was a big change. I think the second biggest change that ever happened with Cloud Foundry was this Diego project that, you know, we've been demoing now, led by a guy named Unsi, a very talented guy. And we've realized that we needed to be more modular. So one of the things about Cloud Foundry that was a fair criticism of it was that it was fairly monolithic in terms of adopting it. You needed the whole thing. And I'm really excited that using Golang with Diego, for Diego, we've been able to really take down the overall payload and the memory footprint and give you a modular piece of code that you could just use as your own little container scheduler at great scale with high availability built into it. You don't have to adopt all of the, you know, identity access primitives, the deployment primitives of Cloud Foundry in order to use that. You can get up and going with it.
So it's kind of inspired by some of the micro paths like Flynn and Deus and Doku that are out there. Is that right?
Well, I think Diego is really, it emerged naturally from an optimization. So when you look at Netflix, they say after we got over 100 developers, we needed to start to use microservices in order to continue to everyone to be able to develop on their own. So I would say that actually Diego was an output of us hitting our own 100 developer speed of light problem where you needed to start to break apart and have clear separation of concerns and develop a more microservice-based approach. I think that's a natural way for software to evolve, right? Like you don't want to architect preemptively, right? Premature optimizations can be a little scary. But I think one of the reasons why Diego's been so well done is that it came with, you know, 2.5 years of mileage on the system in order to how to appropriately architect that container scheduler as a microservice.
Great. So I'm going to link to an awesome video that shows off Diego in the show notes. So if anybody wants to see it, they can go deep. But if you can just give the super short elevator pitch to a developer, what is Diego essentially?
Yeah, I mean, so Diego is a very app-centric container scheduler. So it allows you as a developer for it to be the exact same if you're working with one scale out of one container or scale out of 10,000. You'll see in the demo that they do a simple push. It starts the container up. We have a specialized routing system that's written in Go that just binds to the container, brings HTTP traffic into each app instance that gets started. And then you just make command line arguments like Diego scale 300, and suddenly you have 300 instances. And because of the way the system's written, that takes about 30 seconds to go from 1 to 300 instances.
Wow.
All load balancer, all automatically scaled, all with a tiny footprint. So it makes working at small scale or arbitrarily large scale the same thing for a developer. I think that's a big shift from working in that kind of single VM container environment that a lot of people start in.
And is Diego a bunch of projects? Is it just one Go binary? What is it?
It's a couple of binaries to install, and it includes etcd. So it uses etcd currently as it's one of its pluggable systems, so the nodes know, you know, what's been published and who's running how many instances of each application and where the auction is transacted. So it consumes etcd, and then it's got a couple of other Go binaries that go with it. And I think over time, we'd like to make it very accessible. So imagine that being the app-get easy part of Cloud Foundry, right? You might not adopt the entire system, but you can able to set that system up very rapidly on any number of VMs for yourself.
So Diego itself is clusterable. Is that out of the box? Can you run Diego on multiple servers?
Yeah, so you can run Diego with, in the non-HA way, you'd have a single node of etcd, and a number of fan-out agents that would run the apps, and in a high availability mode, you'd have three nodes of etcd and an arbitrary number of Diego nodes. And you can include routers if you want to get traffic in and out of your app. And then the other upgrade is you can include a log aggregator. And that's sort of the, you know, what we call the new micro PaaS, is that you've got HTTP as a service, you've got logging as a service, and you've got health management and scheduling as a service.
That sounds really cool. So is Diego very like, does it use containers or does it use Docker? What is it backended with?
Yeah, so Diego's all native to, so Diego does not include within it the build pack system. The build pack system would still be handled before Diego, and then it would be handed the container to run. So Diego actually really benefits from there being a whole ecosystem of apps described as containers. So you can just hand it a Docker container, a Docker image, and let it run that. And it uses Linux containers under the covers to do that. The really cool thing about Diego, though, is it can also schedule to Windows. So Diego was built in a way that it can start and stop processes on Windows as well. And we think this is a unique advantage, certainly for enterprise customers. I just left one down in Foster City, where that was the big topic was, can you also run my Windows apps in the same scheduler? And they're pretty excited that it can do that.
How does it do that? Does it use containers on Windows, or does it use native Windows stuff?
It uses native Windows extension, but it runs the agent on Windows and start and stops the app processes as if it was in containers. And there's some, you know, different ways of getting those Windows processes to behave more and more as if they're a Linux container over time, and that's going to be an interesting part of the roadmap. It'd be great to see, you know, Microsoft's got some catch-up to do in order, you know, what the Linux ecosystem has done with containers. Microsoft is not currently at parity, so it'll be interesting to see how they keep up.
Yeah. So what is Pivotal's current relationship with Docker? It seems like there's been a lot of activity around Pivotal and Docker and the foundations. Can you tell us about kind of the state of those things?
Yeah, I think we're really excited about Docker because it gives us another unit of currency. So before, we could run your Ruby app or your Java app, and now we can just take your Docker image and run that. So we think that opens up our addressable, you know, usefulness in a great way. And it natively exposes that we've been using containers all along. So it's really, we've been using containers since 2010, frankly, just like Heroku has. But the people that weren't using containers back then were developers themselves. And so what Docker provides is it provides suddenly a bridge of experience where PaaS runs the container and the developer uses the container on their laptop. Whereas before, the fact that it was container was really hidden from the developer experience and sort of irrelevant, other than the fact that it was a much faster system. I do think, though, that Docker doesn't know what its business model is yet. So if you think about being Docker Inc., and you've just raised $400 million, your valuation of $400 million, you're under a lot of pressure to figure out what you do to create value. And I do think over time there'll be some uncertainty between Docker and its entire ecosystem around, like, who are they going to take on and who are they going to, you know, they've got to create value, right? They can't just be an image format and be worth, you know, the money that they are. So I think that we're friendly and we're both looking at the other kind of going, hey, what's your next move? So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, and Docker is on the Cloud Foundry Foundation, is that right?
They are. So Docker joined the Cloud Foundry Foundation. I consider myself, you know, reasonably good acquaintances with Ben and Solomon. I think they're really interesting people to work with. And, you know, the person who held my job before at Cloud Foundry was Jerry Chen, who's the lead investor in Docker. So it is a very, very small world. I think there's some very interesting ways that we can work together in a joint business model between the two of us. And we could help bring them to, you know, our enterprise customers that we do have for Cloud Foundry already.
Got it. So roughly how many people are deploying Cloud Foundry clusters today? What's the kind of size of the ecosystem?
Yeah, you know, what's amazing is that I never really fully can grok it. It's not nearly the grassroots kind of every developer in the world phenomena because it is a large system. At the same time, you know, we're probably going to do, double-digit number of deals in China this quarter, potentially. around Cloud Foundry. And the reason is that Cloud Foundry was a viral hit in China. You know, Baidu, the search engine of China, famously came out and did a deck about how they use Cloud Foundry behind the scenes. Meeting with the CTO of Alibaba on Saturday. So we are a huge viral hit in China. And I'd say that there are any number of Cloud Foundry installs out there that I don't know about. But you know, I'd say that we're in the thousands of Cloud Foundries, not the hundreds of thousands, because we're not a mass developer phenomenon. And I'd say that we're approaching 100 enterprises that are seriously using Cloud Foundry in a meaningful way as part of their system. And we're starting to get calls from various ISVs saying, hey, we better start supporting Cloud Foundry because our enterprise customers are headed that way.
Wow, that's really cool. So not only do you have the Cloud Foundry project, you also have a commercial enterprise version of the Cloud Foundry project, but you also have a hosted version called Pivotal Web Services.
Right.
Can you share the number? How many people are using Pivotal Web Services?
Yeah, so there's about 200 to 250,000 people that are on Pivotal Web Services at any given time.
Wow. And
it's we didn't go for complete volume there. Like, we don't have a free tier, so we weren't trying to get everyone in the world to sign up for it. What we did is we priced it at a very low rate, so we've started to get very successful with people that don't want that free tier, but they actually want to go build a business on it, and they need to scale their applications, and they need to do it economically. You can run an app on Pivotal Web Services for as cheap as $2.75 a month, because it's only 3 cents a gigabyte hour for the memory, which is cheaper than the cost of Amazon on-demand VMs. So we've gone a different way, which is that we want the most number of highly active users, as opposed to the most number of people who've done Hello World or they're hosting WordPress for free. And what that allows us to do with Pivotal Web Services, we're not making money off of it. It's priced at break even for us, but it helps us burn in the software. So before you ever get to our enterprise edition, it's been running in Pivotal Web Services for maybe about 6 to 8 weeks. And so when we hand someone the software, we know that they can run a platform with it because we have.
Got it. And is it for production environments? Is it for dev test? What is it built for, the web services side?
Yeah, it's absolutely for production environments, but we don't put a big enterprise SLA around it. So we carry PagerDuty on it. It's a 24/7 monitored environment, always up. We run Pivotal on it. So our Pivotal network, where everyone downloads the software to, in fact, buy it and transact on it, that all runs in Pivotal Web Services. Our Spring community runs there. Almost everything at Pivotal runs on it. So it's a mission-critical environment. We haven't done a big SLA. We think that managed service providers like CenturyLink, who I think you've been acquainted with, and my good friend Jared up there, will ultimately be the right place to get a higher SLA managed services for enterprises. And we want to be there for developers and very low-end startups that need a really cost-efficient place to do things.
Got it. That makes a ton of sense. So what's the difference between the open source project and Pivotal CF, the enterprise project?
Yeah, I think the cool thing about the Cloud Foundry Foundation that's come out, and for people not familiar, one of the biggest changes in Cloud Foundry that's not technical, I mentioned the two technical changes, which I thought Build Packs and then Diego. But the non-technical changes we did, we were approached by IBM, who'd made this billion-dollar bet on Cloud Foundry to be their hosted service, Project Bluemix. And they wanted the comfort to have, an open foundation, open governance, to allow them to invest in that, knowing that we couldn't do anything against their interest. So, HP, IBM, SAP, and a list of about 35 others have joined the foundation. So we've got this great commitment from that foundation to only allow you to call it Cloud Foundry if it is the core bits that we ship together. So unlike OpenStack, where you can just call it OpenStack if you hacked it in half and you're supporting, only a quarter of the APIs, Cloud Foundry is actually a very discrete thing. It is our API set, the cloud controller. It is going to be the Diego app scheduler, our routing tier, our command line. That has to always be consistent. So that's a very important part of the Cloud Foundry value prop, is that every Cloud Foundry you go to will be consistent and run your app in the exact same way. Pivotal CF, what we do is we add value around those APIs that are consistent with all Cloud Foundries. So we make it very easy to install it with Operations Manager. You can plug that into vSphere or OpenStack, or EC2 is coming. And just a few clicks and you've got a platform up and running. And then we're also adding app performance management features at the developer console layer to provide more insight into performance of your application again. But the philosophy is that we don't offer a better version of Cloud Foundry. We offer a supported enterprise distribution of Cloud Foundry with better management tools.
Got it. And how does Cloud Foundry deal with data services?
Yeah, so in Cloud Foundry parlance, the data services are deployed by Bosch. So we've got a very cool Galera-based clustered MySQL service that's now out in the open source. It's been very popular already with enterprises that want to cut down the cost of, say, MS SQL or Oracle, and they can buy an enterprise product now that includes a database as a service. And we announced a partnership this month with CloudBees. I'm not sure if you saw how CloudBees pivoted. I'll just say this, it's a really small world. Like, DocCloud was originally a PaaS, and now they're Docker, and we support Docker. AppFog was a PaaS based in part on Cloud Foundry, and now we have a big partnership with them. CloudBees pivoted to just be a Jenkins service and in part for Pivotal CF, so we've got that as a service. So it's amazing, like, that whole startup ecosystem that you and I were rattling around in now is all kind of coalesced around a common set of patterns, or they've gotten smaller. But we have great partner support in delivering data services on Pivotal CF too. So we'll be working with DataStax on a Cassandra service, and we, you know, announced the Jenkins service, etc. So those data services are all pluggable things deployed by Bosch within the Cloud Foundry framework.
So to our audience that might not know what Bosch is, what is Bosch, yeah, and what is it similar to? Is it like a chef? Is it like a puppet, or is it something different?
Yeah, it's, you know, if you really had to think about what Bosch does, I think there's not any tool out there quite like it. Some of the stuff that's come out from HashiCorp around Terraform, you know, allows you to do this concept of declarative infrastructure. So I wanted to declare what my system looks like. So Bosch is inspired by Borg at Google, which, you know, Google's a big fan of these declarative deployments. So I would like to have 55 nodes of Cloud Foundry running, and I want them on these size VMs. And I don't want to have to tell you every step to take, but this is the system that I'd like to see. I want to declare that. And Bosch is a declarative cloud-integrated deployment tool and lifecycle tool, which allows you to just plug into a cloud API and declare the kind of services you want to run on your platform. The reason that's popular is that as the user of it, you just need to simply tell it the scale that you want something to run at once it's set up, and away it goes. Now, it tends to be a little bit more complexity in terms of making those deployments, and I think that's the critique of it, which is that making the deployments is more difficult. But once you've got that declarative manifest ready to go, it's highly repeatable.
So it's a way to kind of create a clustered environment is it a JSON format? Tell us about the format, yeah, behind declaring.
Yeah, so the declarative format is a YAML file where you specify jobs, properties, and resource pools that you would like those jobs to run in. So you'd say, hey, I'd like 50 nodes of MySQL of this size, and these are the available Amazon instances we think those could run on, and I want those to run on these networks.
So it's not exactly like this, but for our audience, if they've ever used something like CloudFormation on Amazon, is it kind of like an open source version of that a little bit?
Yes, I'd say that's a good way of thinking about it. Although it adds additional tools to it, like lifecycle updates. So you can say to Bosch, hey, I want to go from version 1 to version 2. And Bosch knows how to get you there. So it'll say, okay, I'm going to do a rolling update. I'm going to do canary deployments. I'm going to substitute, take VMs in and out of the closter until I get there. Whereas things like CloudFormation don't tend to think about day two operations. Bosch was not always going to be publicly open source. So when it first came out, it was just a tool that we used to run the Cloud Foundry service. But we realized that handing people a platform without the tool to run it wouldn't fully enable them, right? And then they'd all have to come along with bespoke systems, Puppet, Chef, etc., to do that. And that could ultimately slow them down.
Do you need to use Bosch to install Cloud Foundry, or now with the decomposed Diego system, decoupled system, is it possible to do Cloud Foundry without Bosch?
I think it'll be possible to Diego without Bosch because it's a smaller system, it's pretty lightweight. I think if you get into something the full size of Cloud Foundry and some of the data services, Bosch is probably still going to be the best bet. We've had customers that use Chef to deploy Cloud Foundry, so You know, Rakuten over in Japan used Chef to deploy V1 Cloud Foundry before Bosch came out. And what people using large platforms will tell you is that they become a bit more static. It's hard to update them over time. It's the day one is similar. Hey, I'm going to deploy this. It's the day two and the continuous delivery of a platform that is really challenging. And I think not a lot of the market has yet started to think about how do you do continuous delivery of a platform, not just of an app. And Bosch is the kind of tool you start to write when that's what your use case is.
Do you think that Bosch might get decomposed the way that you're decomposing Cloud Foundry into looser coupled things?
I'd say that in general is an important architectural step, and we've started to extract the cloud provider interfaces. So one of the things that Bosch does pretty well is it integrates directly into cloud. So you plug it into Amazon, and away it goes. It uses the APIs. You don't just deploy VMs and then come in and deposit an agent. Bosch actually creates the infrastructure for you. So we've extracted that cloud provider interface, that CPI, from the system and allowed that to be modular. It's very interesting. You can start to write other applications that use that cloud provider interface then, right? So you might say, hey, Diego could be popular on its own. Maybe our router becomes popular on its own. That cloud provider interface automation could become popular on its own. And I think that's where we need to go as a project to attract that more grassroots hacker community, as opposed to just the high-end enterprise who want an extant complete system.
Could you ever imagine building a Docker CPI for Bosch so that you could actually deploy Cloud Foundry on Docker?
Yeah, in fact, we already have a prototype of, this will blow your mind, a Diego CPI for Bosch. So you would deploy Cloud Foundry to Diego with Bosch.
And then there would be Diego on the bottom, then Bosch, and then Diego on the top that was installed. Is that right?
Yeah, so what would happen was Bosch would deploy everything it needs. Bosch would run in a virtual machine, but it would deploy everything it needs to Diego. It's more of a sideways relationship.
I see.
You would get all of your Cloud Foundry deployed on Diego itself. This is important. You know, I just came from this meeting with the CTO of a large medical device company, and they run cloud services, but they also run in-hospital services. And what they're really excited about with Diego is its small Go footprint, and the fact that you could install it anywhere in a very lightweight way meant that they could run those apps in-hospital on machines. And so you could take down the overall footprint of Cloud Foundry itself. When it installs today, some of our cloud controller, some of our other features, they run in VMs today while the apps run in containers. So you can make it even lighter weight by running everything in containers, the system itself.
Interesting. So can you install Diego on your own Mac, or do you need to install Diego on virtual machines like Linux-based systems?
It's Go code, so you could make it run on a number of different things. And I think over time we'll take a look at what the best way of getting community outreach around Diego is. I think it's very interesting to think of what we could do with Diego in the virtual private server market, though, where you've got these little slice hosting, and you might want to put a master Diego node on one and then join the other slices that you've got into that master coordinator. So I think there'll be various ways that we make Diego very accessible.
Is GearD a similar sort of project from Red Hat to Diego, or is it different?
Not being the deepest guy on all the Red Hat tech, I wouldn't want to comment. I think Diego is much more ambitious in terms of its scheduling. So if you want to measure Diego against something, say, hey, how do I go from nothing to app up behind a load balancer at 300 instances in a minute? So how would I do that? What are the kind of tech that I would choose to do that with? And I think you'll find it's pretty unique in its user experience in doing that task. When people take a look at the demo, they'll see that.
Cool. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the PaaS space, the business of platform as a service.
Yeah.
Where do you see the biggest growth opportunity? Is it in grassroots developers, or is it in enterprise adoption?
No way. So I just wrote a blog this week that maybe you can include in the podcast, where I did a pretty big 1,500-word blog with three sections. A little bit in memoriam to a lot of the startups that came out. If you look at Parse, if you look at StackMob, if you look at .cloud even, if you look at CloudBees, going after the I'm going to host public instances of a developer app was popular but not profitable. And only in the case where Mark Benioff got a little drunk one night at dinner and decided to buy Heroku did you have a good financial outcome. At the same time, you know, Cloud Foundry Pivotal CF has generated eight-figure purchase orders, you know, in the enterprise. So if you look at, you know, what we've been able to do selling an enterprise version of a platform to have their own Heroku, their own platform as a service, plus all of our features, you can generate a completely different kind of transaction at that buyer. And that's where I see all the exponential growth. And the great thing about PaaS in the enterprise, or, you know, structured application platforms in the enterprise, is that allows you to pre-bake things in like identity, potentially auth over time, having a unified logging system, auditing, team management. Coordinating large teams and keeping them using the same platform is actually a big challenge in enterprises that the average developer working alone doesn't have. Right? I think that's why you see such extraordinarily large orders at the high end, whereas in the low end, it can tend to be a little bit hard to set up Cloud Foundry by yourself, for yourself. And we'll get better at that, but I think that's where we started off and where the opportunity to make money has been. And if you look at a company like Pivotal, we're not a startup in the sense that we're trying to sell to a bigger company. We're a startup that's very much wants to become our own publicly available, publicly traded company over time. So we're not aiming to sell to Salesforce. We're aiming to be Salesforce. And that's different in terms of, you know, how much money we apply to this project, how many engineers we can afford, and the overall ambition that we have.
That's awesome. Do you have any advice for people that are starting PaaS startups today?
Yeah, I'd say think about whose problem you're trying to solve. So I think a lot of people come at this and they try to do the thing that will get the most attention, which can be good. But you'll find that getting attention and then getting predictable revenue in to, you know, pay the salaries of all the people that need to work at your company in a predictable way are two different challenges. And, you know, I probably wouldn't do a low-end PaaS startup today myself. You know, that's why I'm still at Pivotal and, you know, love what I do, even though I love platform as a service. So I would say definitely know your buyer and what problem you're trying to solve for them ahead of time. Unless you really just want to be a talent acquisition for someone or an acqui-hire and hope for the best there. But I always like to control my destiny. You know, I don't want to be a victim of other people's whims. So I would go after a customer with real money that has a real problem and try to solve that. That's my instincts.
Do you have advice for a small team of really brilliant guys who want to do that but haven't done it before?
I would say solve a discrete part of the problem. So I would say one of the things that you have to have a company the size of Pivotal to take on is we really want to go from the OS the whole way up to the API layer and help you manage all of that. You can't do that in a startup. You know, we're probably going to have over 250 engineers working on that project next year with an additional, you know, 300 to 400 people as a sales force trying to sell it. It's really hard to do that as a startup. So if you're not going to go for that incredible breadth and that incredible kind of, you know, go-to-market push, you know, picking something like, I'll give you an example of a little app that's out there that's pretty cool, like Worker app, which Josh McGinty is really excited about, which just helps you take code. You know, it's a continuous delivery tool, but it's written by a couple of people, but they did it in a nice way, and they've already gotten a little bit of traction with enterprises who need to solve that discrete problem. So when you're in a startup, think about the ecosystem that you're playing in and solve a discrete high-value project problem for them. It's really hard to be a platform startup. So, you know, I'm going to be the thing that everyone else gloms into and own a big, wide layer. That's a big boy's game, I think.
Got it. Can you tell us what's the future of Cloud Foundry?
I think future of Cloud Foundry is it'll really redefine the way enterprises deploy and manage software. And I talk about it today when you walk through an enterprise data center and you see all those machines there, what you have to imagine is there's 30 humans stapled to each rack. And you can't see those humans when you walk through the rack, but there's so much process around enterprise applications today because you have to go and change the network settings to deploy the app. You've got to go and poke a hole in the firewall. You've got to go and ask someone to attach the load balancer. You've got to get which OS version you're using. And, oh, I need to ask the, you know, MySQL admin or the MSSQL admin to give me an account. In Cloud Foundry, you can get up and do that in seconds because all that's baked into the platform. And things like app security groups that we're doing right now where we take that Linux container and we change the IP tables rules at the edge of the Linux container to allow it to talk to different containers or not, I think are just going to be amazing in terms of the automation they can bring to access control for enterprises. So I think, you know, the net, as we say, you're going to go from that human intermediated data center to a software factory. And that's a high-end game, but I think it's one we're prepared to go win.
Interesting. Who do you see as your biggest competitor in the space or frenemy in the space?
I think our biggest competitor is Amazon. So if you look at what Amazon's done, they've done a lot of those things I just described, right? Instead of doing layer two networks, they said, hey, we'll give you VM security groups. Instead of dealing with complex setup of databases, they give you DynamoDB, Elastic MapReduce. Really the PaaS services, if you want to call them that, of Amazon are where they're competing for lock-in. And I think for enterprises, Amazon has become a fairly big brand and a safe bet that if you want to go do innovation projects, Amazon's a place to go do it. And sometimes the, you know, executive buyer these days, he doesn't even know more than that. He just knows, like, hey, Amazon's a good place to go do innovation. Let's go do that. That said, it's still only, you know, sub 10% of the overall market. So there's a lot of opportunity out there. And I'm really thrilled that Google's come to battle. Like, you can say it, nothing less than battle with Amazon, and going to make it much more of a commodity war in terms of those lower-level VM services for price. The whole reason Amazon has those additional sticky services on top are so that you can't move and get off their platform when someone drops the prices. But I think Google's going to make it more of a multiplayer war, and you'll see more and more multi-cloud software evolve.
What's the future of Pivotal?
I think Pivotal is going to be the company that redefines how enterprises, you know, produce great software with a combination of moving fast with our Agile consulting, our Cloud Foundry Pivotal CF, which is, as I said, the next way to turn your data center into a software factory, and then also a way to aggregate insights with all of our Pivotal data services and our big data suite. I think those are the three big topics that are happening right now at the high, you know, in the enterprise market. They're trying to convert to Agile so they can deliver mobile apps faster. They're rethinking how they do their traditional application platforms and reconsidering Oracle and IBM, which a lot of your listeners might not even know that there's these products out there that are sold for, you know, billions of dollars at the high end. And then I think, you know, they're trying to get increased insights out of those new scale-out applications to say, hey, what are the user behaviors? What are the triggers in the application I should be changing to get a better user experience for my my end users with data?
So is Pivotal going to be like the next Sun? Is it what is it going to be like?
I think, in a sense, if you compare us to our two biggest competitors are Oracle and Amazon, right? These are platforms to go build applications. Amazon's the most forward-leaning one out there that includes hardware. Oracle's the laggard, but kind of the enterprise standard today. I think that what you'll see Pivotal be is it'll be the company that disrupts both of those companies in a way, by bringing open source software to a broad community that allows them to write these multi-cloud applications that partners with the latest and greatest, like just like we do with BuildPax, just like we're doing with Docker, just like we do with etcd, that will aggregate some of those hot new technologies into a consistent enterprise platform for folks. And so there's been people that said, oh, hey, is Pivotal and Cloud Foundry going to be disrupted by Docker? Where, you know, if you look at that Diego demo, I don't think there's a faster or more explosive Docker scheduler out there today. And I think that's what makes us such an exciting company, is because we're enterprise, but we embrace new tech very rapidly.
Awesome. Well, it's been awesome picking your brain. Thank you so much for coming on. And I'd love to show the folks more about what you're doing. We're gonna show people more about Diego on the blog. And we're hopefully going to have some integrations that we'll announce soon with Panamax itself. So you'll be able to try out Diego with Panamax with one click. That would be.
We are really excited about Diego plus Panamax. That'll be huge.
Yeah. So stay tuned, and thanks for coming on and spending some time with me.
Thanks for listening to the CenturyLink Labs podcast with Lucas Carlson. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, CenturyLinkLabs.com, to your friends and colleagues. Be sure to check out our archive section on our website for previous podcasts. This has been a CenturyLink production. Join us next time for another edition of the CenturyLink Labs podcast.